There was a letter written to an insurance company. It said, "Dear Sir, I'm writing in response to your request for additional information in Block 3 of the accident report form. I put poor planning as the cause of my accident. You asked for a fuller explanation, and I trust the following details will be sufficient. I'm a bricklayer by trade, and on one day of the accident, I was working alone on a roof of a new six-story building. When I completed my work, I found that I had some bricks left over, which weighed later were found to be slightly in excess of 500 pounds. Rather than carry the bricks down by hand, I decided to lower them in a barrel by using a pulley, which was attached to the side of the building on the sixth floor. Securing the rope at ground level, I went up to the roof. I swung the barrel out and loaded the bricks into it. Then I went down and I untied the rope, holding it tightly to ensure the slow descent of the bricks. You will note in Block 11 of the accident report form that I weigh 175 pounds. Due to my surprise at being jerked off of the ground so suddenly, I lost my presence of mind and forgot to let go of the rope. Needless to say, I proceeded at a rapid rate up the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel, which was now proceeding downward at an equal impressive speed. This explains the fractured skull, minor abrasions, and broken collarbone as listed in Section 3 of the accident report form. Slowed only slightly, I continued my rapid ascent, not stopping until the fingers on my right hand were two knuckles deep into the pulley. Fortunately, by this time, I had regained my presence of mind and was able to hold securely and tightly to the rope, in spite of beginning to experience a great deal of pain. At approximately the same time, however, the barrel of bricks hit the ground and the bottom fell out of the barrel. Now devoid of the weight of the bricks, the barrel weighed approximately 50 pounds. I refer you again to my weight of 175 pounds. As you can imagine, I began a rapid descent down the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming up. This accounts for the two fractured ankles, the broken tooth, and several lacerations on my leg and lower bodies. Here my luck began to change slightly. The encounter with the barrel seemed to slow me enough to lessen my injuries when I fell into the pile of bricks, and fortunately, only three vertebrae were cracked. I'm sorry to report, however, as I lay there on the pile of bricks, in pain and unable to move, I again lost my composure and presence of mind, and I let go of the rope. And I lay there watching the empty barrel begin its journey down to me. This explains the two broken legs. I hope this answers your inquiry." Poor guy. But isn't it comical, but isn't it sometimes all too true that that's kind of the way life goes, and sort of a description of day-to-day life, up and down, a constant vicissitude of change, good and bad and all of these things? Do you one minute just absolutely love life, only to have something like a barrel of bricks come crashing down on top of you? And is your joy just almost immediately turned to anger or resentment or frustration? Do you plow through one trial like Superman, only to be faced with another trial where you just absolutely fail miserably before you can even get started on that one? Perhaps on-again, off-again marriages, child-rearing problems, job problems, money problems, spiritual problems. You think you would be happy if you could have a 30% raise or a different job or a different spouse? Would that solution be the solution to all of your woes and your frustrations and your worries? Does lasting peace and joy and happiness seem to be an elusive dream for you that just never seems to be quite obtainable? Isn't life so often frustrating and seemingly that there's no answers to the problems that we face. Well, there are answers, and that's what I want to cover tonight, answers that come from a man who I believe was inspired by God and why it's in the Bible, that was a whole lot smarter, a whole lot wiser than you and I are. And I don't mean to be offensive by that, but the Bible says that he was the smartest man, the wisest man that has ever lived other than Jesus Christ. And the New Testament reveals that there's one greater than Solomon, who was, of course, Jesus Christ. But Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes because he sought answers. There are several approaches that we could go through in this book. I was talking to someone after service today, and they brought up some things that I had never even thought about, that you can go through the book of Ecclesiastes, and it brings out and points out kind of what's going to happen in the millennium and how they're resurrected, and they are just bumfuzzled, and they're frustrated, and they don't know what to do, and then they get mad at God and begin to blame him, and then you can start teaching them and so forth. But I want to go through this tonight in the sense of how to answer your frustrations. How does the book of Ecclesiastes apply to you? I want to read from the Living Bible. Normally, I do not recommend the Living Bible. I would recommend it for the book of Ecclesiastes. I would recommend it maybe for the Song of Solomon. But other than that, it's a paraphrase version. Now, there is a new translation that is out called the Living Translation, and it is a translation where what I'm going to be reading from is the old Living Bible that many of you are familiar with, and it is not a translation. They kind of read the scripture, and then they say, well, this is what we think it means, or this is what we think it says. And like I said, normally I would not recommend that. But for the book of Ecclesiastes, hopefully you will see why I'm reading from it, and maybe it will make it clearer. It was not translated from the original Hebrew or Greek or anything like that. The book of Ecclesiastes was required reading in ancient Israel at the Feast of Tabernacles. It's one of the five books of the Megaloth, and the book of Ecclesiastes was read every single Feast of Tabernacles. And interestingly enough, it was read on the Sabbath of the Feast of Tabernacles, which of course began this evening. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 1 says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever." He just said it's all kind of futile. It's just all vanity. What's the point? What's the purpose? He just really had a pessimistic viewpoint and outlook once he thought about it. Notice verse 8. He said, "All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be, and that which was done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun." We don't know how much in the past has really existed, but I think it's Herodotus, stand to be corrected, but I think Herodotus is the one that said the Queen of Sheba gave Solomon a flying machine, and she also presented him some type of storage battery that had electricity and so forth. So just like I said, there's nothing new under the sun. They might find a different application or a different use or something like that. In verse 10, it says, "Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It's already been in ancient times before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after." Solomon basically said, man, you go through all this work, you go through all these trials and this labor and this test, and you try as hard as you can, but nobody's going to remember it. So what's the use? He just felt absolutely hopeless and rejected. Then in verse 12, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and to search out wisdom concerning all that is done in heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. And I, in verse 14, have seen all of the works that are done under the sun. And indeed, all is vanity and a grasping for wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have obtained greatness, and I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Obviously, Solomon never heard the sermon that was given this afternoon, so, about narcissism. He said, look, I've gained greatness, and I've gained more wisdom than all that were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived that this also is a grasping for wind, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Obviously, Solomon thought that life was a real bummer. He thought that life was down and out, very frustrating, and a lot of people would agree with him. So many in the world today seemingly have no hope. They don't know the answers. They don't know the solution. They don't know the way out. They see no solution to their problems or to the world's problems. They don't understand about this great feast and what it pictures of the return of Jesus Christ to establish God's kingdom upon this earth and to solve every single one of the problems that this world faces. Ecclesiastes, the second chapter, verses 1 and 2. He says, so what then is the answer? Do you just kind of talk yourself into being happy? He said, I said to myself, I think that's cute, come now, be merry, enjoy yourself to the full. But I found that this too was futile. For it's silly to be laughing all the time. What good does it do? He said, nope, that didn't work. I tried to pull myself up by my own bootstraps. I tried to say, well, let's just be happy and really, you know, look on the positive side and do all this and that. And so then he said, well, I think I'll try to find joy and happiness in a bottle. So in verse 3, so after a lot of thinking, I decided to try the road to drink. And while I was still holding steadily to my course of seeking wisdom, in other words, he didn't just go so overboard that he lost his mind, and he said that didn't work either. Drinking is not the solution to anything, but brings with it an entirely new set of problems far worse than you had before trying to drown them by drinking. And he said, next I changed my course again, and I followed the path of folly so that I could experience the only happiness that most men have through their lives. So he tried to go the route of party hardy. He partied, he planned, he drank, he wine, women, and song. He thought, man, let's just enjoy life, live the party atmosphere to the full. And he said, that didn't work either. That wasn't the solution. Then Solomon got involved in various projects and community service programs and various work things. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 4 through 11. He said, I tried to find fullness in inaugurating a great public's worth program, homes and vineyards and gardens. Oh, if I just had a new home. Oh, if I had a bigger home. Oh, if I had this or if I had that or if I could do this, he said. Gardens, parks, and orchards for myself, and reservoirs to hold the water to irrigate my plantations. Next, in verses 7 and 8, next I bought slaves, men and women. Oh, if I just had a maid to take care of the house or a cook. Boy, wouldn't that be nice. And others were born within my household. I also bred great herds and flocks. If I could just be a rancher out in Texas. More than any other kings before me, I collected silver and gold as taxes from many kings and provinces. In the cultural arts, I organized men's and women's choirs and orchestra. He sought fulfillment through music and through the arts. And then there were my many beautiful concubines. And that's what the world thinks is every man's dream, to have 1,000 wives and concubines. It's kind of like the saying I saw one time. It said, with Solomon having 1,000 wives and concubines, you can't help but question his wisdom. So amassing things, he said, that's not the answer. Obtaining more didn't seem to bring satisfaction. Whether they were good things, bad things, it didn't matter. The answer was not there. Here was a man that some biblical scholars have estimated had more money, more wealth than every man, woman, and child, including the United States government, that he had more wealth than everyone in the United States of America. So when he set his heart to do something, he jolly well could do it. He was king. There was no one to tell him no. And so he set his heart to try to find the solution to life's frustrations. And next he goes into things that truly do bring joy and happiness and prosperity. Maybe this book of Ecclesiastes was required reading at the Feast of Tabernacles because it gives solutions to man's problems, to life's problems, to this world's problems that will be instituted in the millennium. I came up with 12 different points as we go through this book that gives the answers to your frustrations and to the world's frustrations. Point number one, answer number one, gain wisdom. Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 12 through 16. Ecclesiastes 2 and verses 12 through 16. Gain wisdom. Now I begin a study of the comparative virtues of wisdom and folly. And he said anyone else would come with the same, can't come to the same conclusion I did. He said, in other words, you don't have to be some rocket scientist or some brain surgeon or something like this. It doesn't take a whole lot of sense and intelligence to realize that all of this physical stuff is not where it's at. So he concluded in verses 13 and 14 that wisdom is of more value than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. For the wise man sees, while the fool is blind. And yet I noticed that there was one thing that happened to the wise and the foolish alike. Just as the fool will die, so will I. So of what value is all of my wisdom? And then I realized that even wisdom is futile. It's not the total answer. It's part of the solution. It's part of the answer, but it is not the total answer. For the wise and the fool both die, and in the days to come, both will be long forgotten. So wisdom is the first thing that Solomon mentions, but even wisdom itself is not the full answer or the total solution to your problems or to this world's problems. It's part of that solution, and it's part of relieving the frustration, and it's a vital part. Because when you stop and think about it, how much misery do we bring on ourselves because of our dumb, stupid mistakes and decisions that we make? And wisdom, which basically is God's truth, is definitely part of the solution. Verses 14 and 15 that we just read, or 14 and 16, talk about death. Have you been through a death with a loved one in your family? Wisdom, God's truth, makes all of the difference in the world when a loved one dies. When you know the truth and you understand the truth, whether that be the truth about the first resurrection or the truth about the second resurrection, then you have hope and you have comfort and you don't sorrow like the rest of the world. Then in verse 17 through 23, he talks about being down, about being down and out, about being discouraged and despondent. Have you ever been so down that looking up seemed almost impossible? That's the way Solomon felt. Then we come to the second answer. He said, enjoy your work and physical things. Ecclesiastes 2 and verses 24 through 26. Enjoy your work and physical things. So I decided that there was nothing better for a man than to enjoy his food and drink and his job. And then I realized that even this pleasure is from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy apart from him? And Solomon began to see that having all these physical things doesn't accomplish anything if it's apart from God. For God gives those who please him wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away from him, and he gives it to those who please him. So here, too, we see an example of foolishly chasing the wind. So many people think if I just had that 10% raise or the 30% I mentioned earlier, if I just had more money, if I could just pay my house off, if I just had all of these physical things, then I would be so happy. And Solomon says, enjoy physical things. Enjoy your job. Enjoy your work. We should enjoy our labor, both physical labor that we do and spiritual labor that we do. And he brings up this point throughout this book. The third answer, timing is critical. Timing is critical. So many things in our lives depend on timing. How many times have you felt like you were a day late and a dollar short? That you had your hopes up, but it just didn't seem to work out the way that you wanted it to work out. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 1. He said, there's a right time for everything. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant, a time to harvest. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to destroy, a time to rebuild. A time to cry, a time to laugh. A time to grieve, a time to dance. A time of scattering stones and a time of gathering stones. A time to hug, a time not to hug. A time to find and a time to lose. A time for keeping and a time for throwing away. A time to tear and a time to repair. A time to be quiet and a time to speak up. A time for loving and a time for hating. A time for war and a time for peace. If there's a right time and a wrong time for virtually everything, but doesn't it seem so often that everything seems to come at the wrong time? In verse 9 of chapter 3, Solomon says that being a workaholic is not the answer. He says spending all of your time working, that's not the solution. You can't work yourself into happiness. You should enjoy our work, point number 2, as he brought out. But being a workaholic is just a shield to hide behind, to cover the unhappiness and the void that's there in a person's life. Then in verse 14, he brings out the principle that he'll focus on in chapter 5 about fearing God. He says, I know this, that whatever God does is final. Nothing can be added or taken from it. God's purpose in this is that man should fear the all-powerful God. Then in chapter 3 and verses 16 and 18, he said, moreover, I noticed that throughout the earth, justice is giving way to crime. You would have thought he lived in our generation. He said, justice is giving away to crime. Even the police courts are corrupt. I said to myself in verse 17, in due season, God will judge everything that man does, both good and bad. And of course, we're here picturing part of that time of judgment. And then the final judgment will come, of course, at the last great day. And he points out, you can't, if you're mistreated, you can't go to court and expect to win, expect to be favored by the court. It's like Christ mentioned that so often you go before the unjust judges that we have to put our faith and our trust and our confidence and our happiness in God and in Christ. Then in verse 18, he said, then I realized that God is letting the world go on its sinful way so that he can test mankind. Might want to remember that scripture when somebody asks why little Johnny died or why their mate died or why they're having this trial or test or something. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 18. And then I realized that God is letting the world go on its own sinful way so that he can test mankind. And so that men themselves will see that they're no better than beast. Without God, they're worth nothing. God has a hands-off policy to this world. People wonder why God let little Timmy die. I believe it applies in many, many different directions. And he goes on and he says that in verse 22, "And so I saw that there is nothing better for men that they should be happy in their work," going back to point number two, "for that is what they are here for. And no one can bring them back to life to enjoy what will be in the future. So let them enjoy it now." Once again, Solomon brings out point number two, that we should find happiness, that we should find satisfaction in our work that we have on this earth. I believe that it's talking about our physical jobs. I think it's talking about our spiritual job. I think it's talking about the work of God, that we put our heart into it, that we enjoy seeing people converted, that it truly is a joy. As our festival elder mentioned, and how many are here for the first time, and we saw the people stand up, and then the applause was just automatic. Because it's exciting to see new people. It's exciting to think about those that are going to be spared from the great tribulation because of your prayers, because of your concern and your example. And he goes on here, and he says that we're to, in chapter 4, in verse 1, he said, "Next I observed all of the oppression and the sadness throughout the earth." As far as I know, Solomon did not have a television. He didn't have the 6 o'clock news, but he did have reporters that repeated things to him that they saw, and they witnessed all of the suffering and the misery around the earth. And he said, "I observed all the oppression and the sadness throughout the earth, the tears of the oppressed, and no one helping them. While on the other side of their oppressors were powerful allies. So I felt that the dead were better off than the living. And most fortunate of all of those who have never been born and have never seen all of the evil and crime throughout the earth. And then I observed that the basic motive for success is the driving force of envy and jealousy. But this too is foolishness, a striving for wind." Seeing the suffering of the world, I know, hurts you. It hurts me. When we do watch the news, we see the children starving, we see the wars going on around the face of the earth, and like Ezekiel said, that there are some that are sealed because they sigh and they cry for the abominations that are going on in this world. Then in verse 7 through 12, Solomon discusses loneliness. Some of you suffer a great deal from loneliness. Do you ever get lonesome? Do you ever get blue? Do you ever get depressed? Do you ever get down? In verse 9, he said, "Two can accomplish more than twice as much as one, for the result can be much better. If one fails or falls, the other pulls him up. And if one falls when he is alone, he's in trouble." And Solomon brings out the modern principle of synergy. Synergy is two or more things functioning together to produce a result that is not independently obtainable. The term synergy comes from the Greek, meaning working together. It means the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of each individual parts. Verses 13 through 16, he mentions that it's better to be wise, to be a wise young person, than a foolish old king. And people, of course, lament constantly, "Oh, if I'd only been born rich, I would have power and respect, and things would be totally different. Life would be so much better." Answer number 4, fear God. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 1 through 7, he says, "Don't make dumb, stupid promises to God." Verse 4, he said, "So when you talk to God and you vow to him that you will do something, don't delay in doing it. For God has no pleasure in fools. Keep your promise to him. It's far better not to say that you're going to do something than to say you will and then not do it. In that case, your mouth is making you sin. Don't try to defend yourself by telling the messenger from God that it was all a mistake to make the vow. That would make God very angry, and he might destroy your prosperity. Dreaming instead of doing is foolishness, and there is ruin in a flood of empty words. Fear God instead." So the wise advice here is do what you're supposed to do. It's just that simple. You know to do right? Do right. You know to shun and avoid evil? Shun and avoid evil. That's what he's saying. Just do what you know you are supposed to do. Then in verses 8 and 9, in that fear of God, we need to trust God that he will do what is best for us. Solomon says, don't get all bent out of shape on politics, whether that be local or national or even among God's people in God's church. I get more emails, political emails, about who to vote for, who is tearing this nation apart, and all of the garbage that's going on. And I agree, it is. But on the other hand, I stop and think that we are commanded to pray, "Thy kingdom come." And then we want to vote for somebody that's going to delay God's kingdom, that's going to make things better, that's going to all of a sudden bring all of this solution. And to me, it doesn't make sense. But anyway, he then, in verses 10 through 17, addresses financial matters, that the solution, again, is to fear God, to trust God, because money will not buy happiness. And this is from the richest man that has ever lived on the face of the earth. In verse 10 and 12, he said, "He who loves money shall never have enough. If you have a dollar, you want two. If you have 1,000, you want 1,000,000. If you have 1,000,000, you want 2,000,000. If you have 1,000,000,000, wouldn't it be nice to have 2,000,000,000? If you have 2,000,000,000, man, think of what you could do with 1,000,000,000,000. You couldn't count it in your lifetime, but at least you'd have it. But he says, "He who loves money shall never have enough. The foolishness of thinking that wealth brings happiness." This is the second wisest man that has ever lived, and the number one richest man that has ever lived. And he says, you're foolish for thinking that wealth brings happiness. That's not the solution. "The more you have," he continues in verse 11, "the more you spend, right up to the limits of your income. In the United States of America, the average family spends 10% more than what they make at every level. That includes those who are at the poverty level. That includes those that are the middle class. And that includes those that are the very wealthy. On average, the average family in the United States spends 10% more than they make. Never happy. The more you have, the more you spend, right up to the limits of your income. So what's the advantage of wealth, he says, except perhaps to watch it as it runs through your fingers. The man who works hard sleeps well, whether he eats little or much. But the rich must worry and suffer insomnia. Is my alarm system working? Is my safe okay? What about that investment? Oh, no, I heard it went down 20% today. How many millions of dollars did that cost me? And he said they suffer insomnia. Verse 13 through 17, he discusses the foolishness of unwise investments and decisions. where we back ourselves into a corner and we get into hot water. Then in verse 18 through 20, we find the fifth answer, and that is to be content with what you have. Be content with what you have. He said, well, one thing at least is good. It is for a man to eat well, drink a good glass of wine, accept his position in life, and enjoy his work, whatever his job may be, for however long the Lord may let him live. And of course, it's very good if a man has received wealth from the Lord and good health to enjoy it. To enjoy your work and to accept your lot in life, that is indeed a gift from God. The person who does that will not need to look back with sorrow on his past, for God gives him joy. Isn't that the same thing that the Apostle Paul said in Philippians 4 and verse 11, when he said, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. And everywhere in all things, he said, I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. And he said, I can do, in verse 13, all things through Christ which strengthens me. That is a tremendous key in solving your personal frustrations. Ecclesiastes 6 goes on and talks about health problems and winding up poor and broke like so many of our senior citizens today because of medical expenses and drug expenses and so forth. But it talks here specifically about being broke because they're never satisfied with what they have. That they're not content and they want this or they want that, or this one's bigger and better, or this one's shinier and prettier. Oh, if I could just get that car, or if I just had that house, or if I could have this new clothes or this or that, or oh, that would make me happy. In chapter 7, we find another answer to your frustrations. And the answer number 6 is live a clean, righteous, wholesome life. Live a clean and righteous, wholesome life. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. It says, a good reputation is more valuable than the most expensive perfume. Clive Christian perfume is the most expensive perfume in the world. It is only $12,722 an ounce. You can buy a 16.9-ounce bottle for $215,000. Now, those of you that have been wanting to get my wife a gift, she'd rather have the money, by the way. But he said a good reputation is more valuable than perfume that costs $215,000. Because once you lose that reputation, it's almost impossible to ever win it back. You're branded for the rest of your life. When you do something foolish in your marriage, you're branded for the rest of your life. When you do something foolish on the job, you're branded for the rest of your life. And it is so difficult to ever rise above it. But when you serve God, you live a clean life, you obey God, you can't go wrong. Your reputation is in full tack. Verses 2 through 4, he said, it's better to spend your time at funerals than at festivals. For you're going to die, and it's a good thing to think about it while there is time. In other words, while there's time for us to wake up and to change the course of our life. He says sorrow in verse 3 is better than laughter, and sadness has a refining influence on it. Yes, a wise man thinks much about death. We think about our future. We think about whether or not we're qualifying to be in God's kingdom. We think about our rulership with God. A wise man thinks much about death, while a fool only thinks of having a good time now. In other words, live your life for tomorrow, not just for the pleasures of today. Live like you want to be in God's kingdom. Live like it really, truly means something to you. That's your life, that's your goal, that's your hope, that you want to be a son of God, born into His very family. Truly let Matthew 6 and verse 33 be the guiding star of your life, be your true north. Then in verse 5 through 9, he discusses the embellishments of character. He said, it's better to be criticized by a wise man than to be praised by a fool. For a fool's compliment is as quickly gone as paper and fire. And it's silly to be impressed by it. He said, the wise man is turned into a fool by a bribe. It destroys his understanding. Finishing is better than starting. Patience is better than pride. Don't be quick-tempered. That is being a fool. What if we applied that one point to our marriages? You think it would be different? Don't be quick-tempered. That is being a fool. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10. He said, don't long for the good old days, for you don't know whether they are any better than these. And how many people live by the philosophy, if only? If only this would have happened. Or if only that would not have happened. If only I had done this. Or if only I would have done that. Then things would be different. If only, if only, if only. Absolutely learn from the past mistakes. But do not try to go back and relive them and revive them and resurrect them. So many have serious marriage problems because they cannot forgive, because they cannot forget what has happened in the past. Learn from it, but do not resurrect it. In verse 11 through 17, Solomon refers back to point number one, wisdom. That we have to have wisdom to cope with what life throws at us. Then he gives a summary in verse 18 of point 4, which was fear God. He said, tackle every task that comes along. And if you fear God, you can expect His blessings. So if you want a good life, have wisdom and fear God, and the rest will work out. In verses 21 and 22, Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 21. He said, don't eavesdrop. You may hear your servant cursing you. For how do you know that, for you know how often you yourself curse others. So he said, in other words, don't gossip. It has a way of coming back home. It brings misery, and it has a way to come back and bite you. Don't talk about other people. I was amazed here about 3 years ago how people just loved gossip. They could not wait to get home and get on the internet and find out the latest lie and find out the latest little juicy tidbit that they possibly could. And boy, they just wallowed in it and they couldn't wait to pass it on. And so, excuse me. In verse 26, he said, a prostitute is more bitter than death. May it please God that you escape from her, but sinners don't evade her snares. So guys or women, he says, a better sex life is not the answer to your frustrations. So you're stupid, absolutely stupid, if you go outside of your bedroom to, quote, seek happiness. It is dumb, it's foolish, it's stupid, and you will suffer as a result for the rest of your life. Absolutely, 100% stupid. Verse 27 and 20 through 29. This is my conclusion, says the preacher. Step by step, I came to this result after researching in every direction. He said, ladies, of 1% of men I interviewed could said be wise, but not one woman. He obviously never met my wife and a lot of these women in this room. I have found that though God had made men upright, each has turned away to follow his own downward road. He said in verse 20, backing up, he said, and there's not a single man in all of the earth who is always good and never sins. And of course, as Romans 6 and verse 23 says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. We all sin. We all make mistakes, both men and women. We all need wisdom. We need to be praying for wisdom. James said, if any lacks wisdom, let him pray and ask for that. Beseech God for wisdom. And in that wisdom, then, seek perfection of God. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 1. How wonderful, he said, to be wise, to understand things, to be able to analyze them and interpret them. Wisdom lights up a man's face, softening its hardness. When you gain wisdom, you gain a tenderness. You gain a compassion, a love, a softness, instead of a hard-heartedness. And always being critical and angry and frustrated, but instead you gain a heart of love and compassion. Answer number 7. Don't worry. Don't worry. Ecclesiastes 8 and verses 6 through 8. Yes, there's a time and there's a way for everything, as he brought out in point number 3. Though a man's trouble lies heavy upon him, for how can he avoid what he doesn't know is going to happen? No one can hold back his spirit from departing. You can't keep yourself from dying. No one has the power to prevent his day of death. For there is no discharge from that obligation. All are going to die. And that dark battle. Certainly a man's wickedness is not going to help him then. But he's saying here, don't worry about things you can't control. Don't worry about things that you don't have any control over. Isn't that the same thing that Christ said in Matthew, the 6th chapter? He said, don't worry about all this physical stuff, about the food that you're going to eat, the clothes that you're going to put on, the physical things. He said, even Solomon wasn't arrayed like one of these lilies and so forth. He said, don't worry about those things that are beyond your control. If you're going to worry, then worry about whether or not you're righteous. Whether or not you're going to be in God's kingdom. Then in chapter 8 and verse 9 through 13, he said, I have thought deeply about all that goes on here in the world, where people have the power of injuring one another. Wonder how many people we have hurt by the things that we have said. I remember as a child, there was a saying going around that sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That's a lie. Words hurt very, very deeply. There's things that you have said to your mate that they will remember until the day they die. There's things that you have said and done to others that have cut them to the core. He said, I've thought deeply about all that goes on here in the world where people have the power to injure each other. I have seen wicked men buried, and as their friends return from the cemetery, having forgotten all of the dead man's evil deeds. These men are praised in the very city where they have committed their many crimes. He said, that's weird. He said, that's odd. Because God does not punish sinners instantly, people feel it's safe to do wrong. But though a man sins 100 times and still lives, I know very well that those who fear God will be better off. Unlike the wicked who will not live long good lives, their days shall pass away as quickly as shadows because they don't fear God. Here Solomon reflects back on point number 5. Obey God, fear God, if you want to have a good, prosperous, wonderful, happy life. Then in verse 14, there's a strange thing happening here upon the earth. Providence seems to treat some good men as though they're wicked, and some wicked men as though they're good. And this is all very vexing and troublesome. Doesn't it seem like at times that you really try to get on the ball, you really try to draw close to God, and you really start dedicating yourself in prayer and Bible study and trying to serve others, and then the harder you try, it seems like sometimes the worse things get. I believe the more you dedicate yourself to God, the more Satan gets upset. And he wants so much to keep you out of God's kingdom. But God promises that if you resist the devil, he will flee from you. And he also gives another promise, and he says if you draw close to him, God will draw near unto you as well. Answer number eight. Answer number eight. Enjoy physical things in balance. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 15. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 15. Enjoy physical things in balance. Then I decided to spend my time having fun, because I felt there was nothing better in all the earth than a man should eat and drink and be merry with all of the hope that happens would stick with him, that all this happiness, would stick with him, that you can go out and you can have a really good time, and boy, that's going to last. You know, you can bring it home and you can think about it and you think, oh boy, this is wonderful. And that will stick with him and all of the hard work, the labor, the trials and the tests that God has given to mankind everywhere. Then in verse 1 of chapter 9, verses 1 through 4, he says, don't blame God and say that God's cursing you. Don't be psychotic. Don't be neurotic and think that God's out to get you, that God is out to destroy you. And frankly, some in God's church do. They really, truly, honestly have never understood the love, the deep love, the motivating love, the power of God. Solomon continues through chapter 9 and verse 7, and he says, so go ahead, eat, drink, and be merry, for it makes no difference to God. Wear fine clothes with a dash of cologne. You can go out and buy this $215,000 cologne. Now, I think you know there's better uses for that. But he says, you know, it's okay to use physical things in balance. Live life, love life, enjoy life, but do it in the fear of God. Then answer number 9, a happy marriage. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9. He says, live happily with the woman you love through the fleeting days of your life, for the wife God gives you is the best reward down here in all of your earthly toil. Having a happy marriage is the number one reward that you have in this life. J. Paul Getty, who is the richest man that's ever lived in my lifetime, and probably your lifetime, made the statement that he would have given all of his billions and billions of dollars for one happy marriage. And you, knowing God's truth, have that opportunity to have that one happy marriage. And yet, how many foolishly seemed like they absolutely try to destroy it. Having a happy marriage is the number one reward that we have in this life. You think maybe, perhaps, you need to spend more time on your marriage, since that's your number one blessing in life? Do you think maybe it's worth a staggering investment of time and energy, since that is the number one thing, the number one joy, the lasting joy of this life? He goes on in verse 11 and 12, and he says, time and chance happens to us all. And that's the same thing, of course, that Christ brought out. And then Solomon gives advice on how to behave on the job. In Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 4, he says, if the boss is angry with you, don't quit. Don't be a fool. He says, you control yourself. He says, a quiet spirit will quiet his bad temper. Same principle is brought out in Proverbs, the 15th chapter, and verse 1, where he says, "A soft answer turns away wrath, and harsh words stir up anger." Again, what if we applied that to our marriages, to our children, to our relationships one with another? A soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. Then in verse 15, he says, "Don't be easily upset. Work hard. Control your temper." How many times has our temper gotten us in a dump truck load of problems and frustration? I remember a man who was working on his car, and the wrench slipped, and he hit his knuckles, and it made him so mad that he took that wrench and he threw it through the windshield. Cost him something like $250. He really, you know, that really helped, didn't it? He lost his temper. How many times have you ever lost your temper and it worked out good? No takers? Solomon says, love life, control yourself. Answer number 10. Learn to give and to share. Learn to give and to share. Ecclesiastes 11 and verses 1 and 2. He said, "Give generously, for your gifts will return to you later. Divide your gifts among many, for in the days ahead you yourself may need much help." And how do we know? This was Solomon's problem. He never learned to heed his own wisdom and his own solution. He had all of this great wealth, and yet he did everything for himself instead of giving and sharing. Answer number 10, learn to give and to share. Answer number 11, love life and be thankful. Verses 7 and 8 of Ecclesiastes 11. Verses 7 and 8, Ecclesiastes 11. He said, "It's a wonderful thing to be alive." And isn't that the truth? Aren't we thankful that we are able to be here tonight? So many are not. There's people in iron lungs. There's people that are on the verge of dying. There's people that will die tonight. 15,000 to 25,000 children starve to death today. And they will tomorrow and the next day. But he says here, he says it's a wonderful thing to be alive. If a person lives to be very old, let him rejoice in every day of his life. But let him also remember that eternity is far longer, and that everything down here is futile in comparison. This life is not where it's at. This life is not the solution. I heard a minister say one time that God didn't intend this life to work. That we have trials and tests to develop character to help us to be in God's kingdom. And he goes on here, he says, be thankful every day. That accentuate the positive and be a thankful person, not a grumbler, not a complainer, not someone that hops on Job's horse and woe is me. That we say, oh, you know, oh, I'm going to go down and boy, I tell you, I've got it rough and all, oh, if you only knew. And yeah, you know, there's some people you run into and you wish you'd run over them instead of into them. But, you know, and by the time you leave, you feel like you just got a wet blanket all over you. You feel like it that just rained on you, you know, or you want to look on your shoulders and see if some bird messed on you or something. And then others, you talk to them, and it's so edifying and uplifting, and I don't care what kind of mood you're in, you walk away from them, and you've got a smile and a joy and a happiness. And he says, love life, be thankful, accentuate the positive. And then he addresses the young people. He says to love life and enjoy life and do it by obeying God. Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 9 through 12, and actually on through 12 through chapter 12 through 8. He says, young man, it's wonderful to be young. And that is a great blessing. It's like the old saying goes that many of us old codgers can adhere to, that it's a shame that youth is wasted on the young. He said, enjoy every minute of it. Do all you want to. Take in everything. But realize that you must account to God for everything you do. So banish grief and pain. Don't bring sorrow on yourself. He said, banish grief and pain. But remember that youth, with a whole life before it, can make serious mistakes. And then in Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 1, he continues and he says, don't let the excitement of being young cause you to forget about your Creator. Honor Him in your youth before the evil years come, when you'll no longer enjoy living. It may be too late then to try to remember Him when the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are dim in your old eyes, and there's no silver lining left among your clouds. For there will come a time when your limbs will tremble with age, and your strong legs will become weak. Most young people kind of feel like they're immortal, but if they live, this is going to come to pass. And your teeth will be too few to do their work, and there will be blindness too. Then let your lips be tightly closed while eating, while your teeth are gone. In other words, don't dribble all over yourself. And you will waken at dawn with the first noise of the birds. Don't you just hate it? But you will yourself be deaf and tuneless with a quavering, weak voice. You will be afraid of heights and of falling, and a white-haired, withered old man. At least I'm not white-headed. Both of mine are gray, but anyway. Dragging himself along without sexual desire, which is so important to so many young people, standing at death's door and nearing his everlasting home as the mourners go along the streets. Yes, in verse 6, Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 6, remember your Creator now while you are young, before the silver cord of life snaps and the gold bowl is broken, before the pitcher is broken at the fountain and the wheel is broken at the cistern. Then the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So young people, he says, love life, enjoy life, live it to the full, but do it by obeying God. Sin never, never, never brings happiness and joy. Oh, the Bible talks about sin or pleasure for a season, but it's very short-lived. That 15 minutes, that hour, that whatever, it's just flat not worth it. He says, love life, enjoy life, but do it by obeying God, because after all, that is the only way you are going to be happy and really enjoy life. Point number 12. Answer number 12. Fear, obey, and love God, because our reward, our real happiness, is coming in another world and time. The time that is pictured by this great Feast of Tabernacles. Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter, in verses 13 and 14. Here is my final conclusion. Ecclesiastes 12, in verse 13 and 14. Mr. Martin read this today. Here is my final conclusion. Fear God, obey, and obey His commandments, for this is the entire duty of man. As the King James says, this is the whole of man. This is the only way that you can be whole and happy. For God will judge us for everything we do, including every hidden thing, good or bad. So he sums it up and he says the entire solution is fear, love, and obey God, that that is the only way that you can be a whole, happy person. So we've seen here tonight 12 keys and answers to your frustrations and to this world's frustrations. Number one, seek wisdom. Number two, find happiness and fulfillment in your work, both physical and spiritual. Number three, timing is critical. Number four, fear God. Number five, learn to accept the state and the standard of your life that you are in. Number six, live a clean life. Number seven, do not worry. Number eight, enjoy the physical things in balance. Number nine, have a happy marriage. Number 10, learn to give and to share. Number 11, live life and be thankful. Number 12, the whole entire solution. Fear, obey, and love God. That is the only way to be a whole, happy person. This book of Ecclesiastes contains keys and answers to your frustrations to give you genuine happiness and to this world's frustration and happiness as well. You have to meditate on these things to find out how you can apply these keys to unlock the frustrations and the problems of your life. Thank you very much for coming. I hope it was profitable. Thanks a bunch.